So this is an opportunity to exchange any problems or concerns or questions or whatever you'd like to about your practice in your daily life on the cushion, or whatever ways that you would like to pose the question. And if you'd like to dialogue around those questions, that's fine. Or if you'd just like to ask the question, and anything at all. So I just open it up. And if you don't mind, because I'm trying to record this, although depending upon the quality of the answers, we may... it may not get up into the web. But in any case, if you'd be concise about your question so that I can repeat it for the tape. Yes?
Suddenly I've been having a hard time staying awake while during meditation. I keep falling asleep. Didn't happen as of a month ago.
Right. So the question is, he's having a hard time staying awake recently. As of a month ago, he wasn't having that kind of difficulty. My obvious question is, has there been any unusual situation that has happened in the last month emotionally impact you? Has there been a waning of your intentionality in meditation?
It's been spotty, and there's days that I've skipped it and had to get myself back to it.
Right. Are you sort of shooting yourself into the meditation?
I don't know what precisely that means.
That means like I should do it. It's not really coming from any sense of compelling interest in it. It's coming from like, this is something that's good for me. It's like taking cod liver oil. Yes.
And then it sort of fell off.
Right.
And he's trying to get back to what that was.
Right. So he's trying to get back to, at the beginning it was very interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, it is in the beginning. And then it gets routine.
Yeah.
Right, because what you've seen and the repetition of what you've seen. And it also gets more difficult as the practice settles a little. You begin to see not necessarily the excitement of seeing something new or a different perspective of yourself, but the difficulty of what you've been carrying with yourself for such a long period of time. And at that point, there can be a radical shift of interest, as you might think, as you confront the more difficult areas of yourself, or just it's not holding the excitement, and you begin to see that what we often are addicted to are the periods of where something holds an exciting quality, like a romance. When you first get involved, that sense of newness in getting to know the person, and then when you have to deal with their issues, which inevitably you have to do, and the rose color enamoration wears off, and you're left with the person, you can do one of two things. You can move on to a new relationship, which many people do, or you can really mature in your understanding of what this relationship to the meditation is about. Because it never was about keeping you excited, right? Now, the other thing that happens early on in the meditation that's very difficult is that you're not seeing very much, really. Nothing insightful is happening because the mind is being trained just with the ability to hold its attention on something. And that takes a good deal of time. It can't be bypassed and it can't be shortened. You know, it has a kind of discipline approach to it. It's sort of like sharpening a blade so that it can cut. Meanwhile, you're caught up in many of the hindrances and don't have the ability to see the nuances of how we're engendering those hindrances. We just feel like we're caught up. We feel like our practice isn't working. We feel like it's routine. Where's this thing all supposed to go? I'm not seeing anything that the books say that I should be seeing. And so we can talk ourselves into discouragement, into despair, or we can talk ourselves into self-doubting that we think we just aren't up to the task of being able to do this. And this is really a very hard time, probably the hardest time in your entire practice, including those moments of terror within your practice. Because at this point, the maturity of mind isn't sufficient to be able to deal with the difficulties, or even to know that those difficulties do not necessarily have to be taken personally. And so they are taken personally, because that's the way we've always taken ourselves. And so there's enormous inward tension when you're just running on what somebody has told you or what you've read in a book, and it feels like the practice itself just isn't bearing fruit. So a couple of things. If you have the opportunity to do a residential retreat, they can be very helpful in spiraling you out of that kind of downward turn. And you'll find that a residential retreat can really give you motivation and give you new insight and compelling issues for why to continue. And it can also deepen your samadhi, your ability to focus and hold your mind steady, which can be very, very helpful. And it can give you a very deep way of looking impersonally at the mind in a very short period of time. So I suggest that, and usually people say, well, am I ready for that? And I don't ever answer that question. I say, does your heart leap towards it? If your heart says, yeah, I'd like to try that, then that's good enough. Don't let your mind then come back in and say, I don't think I'm ready for it. That's just mental doubting. Feel whether I'd like to try that, and then do it. Don't second guess yourself. The other thing you can do is to, and I know this is difficult, but is to practice twice a day, if you have the opportunity, 2 45-minute sittings, and to really bring forth what I call the intentionality of the practice throughout the day, so that you're calling on the practice, calling on the strength of the practice to move through those sittings into your life. And there are a number of ways to do that. One of the best ways is to pause. And when you find yourself busy, when you find yourself too mentally energized, running ahead of yourself, discipline a pause of 30 seconds or so, regardless. So what you do is prioritizing, you're standing up to busyness and you're saying, you know, the compelling issue that keeps me busy is secondary to my sanity of mind. And the pause induces a sanity of mind. I don't care if I'm late for this, a very, very important appointment. Sanity is more important. I'm taking 30 seconds. And you sit there. And you really allow yourself not to think ahead into that next frame of reference, which is one of the most detrimental aspects of life in an urban dwelling compared to a monastic or retreat setting. We think the issues of our life are so important. And yet when we compare those issues to the moment of death, we say, how important was that meeting, how important was that meeting, that appointment, that task, compared to the pause of sanity? And you really get a deep sense of reflective understanding of how, what we do to ourselves. And we give our lives away. What we think is meaningful momentarily or in this particular month or year really does not bear up when you look at it long term, no matter what we're doing. And so that reprioritizing, that willingness to claim reference back to sanity, that willingness to not step out of the practice merely because it's becoming difficult, because if you happen to have a tendency or conditioning towards aversive, uncomfortable settings, so if something becomes uncomfortable, you leave it, which many of us do. Then when the practice becomes difficult, you'll leave that. It's just another relationship that didn't pan out for you, you see? So it really requires a deeper inward intentionality in your life. And so one of the other things I really strongly suggest is before you get out of bed every morning, and when you look at the scope of your activity for that day, in the pause of the alarm, reset your intention. What is this day going to be about for me? What is this, when I get out of bed, what is life, what's the moment of my getting out of bed? How am I going to organize my living so that it means something to me in the deepest sense of that? Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. So refresh yourself and don't expect too much from the practice too quickly. It takes time. And when it starts, it's geometric, not arithmetic. As every, when it starts working, when the ball starts rolling downhill and collects more and more snow, and the snow starts and then adds on to the amount that it becomes, at some point, the momentum is such that you can't call it back up the hill. But when it's just a little teeny, you know, you can. And so it's at that moment that it's most delicate and needs the most support from all of us. That's why we meet as a Sangha. That's why we encourage, we have regular events throughout for people to come to. It's not a one-time and we're done deal. It's a lifetime relationship. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes.
Last Wednesday, I was woke up, my sister called, and a very close family friend died. And he was like an elder to me. He was 73 and killed on his bike just a couple miles from home in Nova Scotia. Your poem was very appropriate. So,
grief.
I guess I thought he was immortal. I've known him since I was six. And went hiking and canoeing and skiing and everything. And I was going to grow up in Salem for 5 months. And then I'll have to go to the church. But nothing really prepared me. Even, I mean, and sitting now every day, it's just very blank.
Sure, I'd be happy to. An inexplicable death. Her friend, a long-standing elder, someone who she's admired and thought was immortal. And I don't say that in any way other than a deep honoring. And she's talking about grief and. And when the world is taken away, I'm going to talk about it from the deepest level to begin with, okay? And then we'll come back up to the human level. You see, it's something that I live with, and I think many people do. When you begin to deeply understand what the point of life is, it's not to give us anything. It's not for the pleasurable experiences or the comforts or the enthralling experiences or the enticing relationships. It's not for, it doesn't, that's not its point. That's not what life is manifesting for. We lose ourselves within the delights of relationship and the delights of living. But the sobriety of what it's really about comes through loss. When you see that the things that we have most counted on being there aren't and can't ever be sustained. Then you, sobering, you bottom out to that kind of heart longing for life to partner with me in a way that it can't. And so then in that despair, through that despair, one begins to see how the whole mechanics of life are to awaken us, and only to awaken us. And they can only get our attention through giving and then pulling back, through giving and then taking away. So that we think we have them, and we think we have it, and then it recedes, and then it's gone, including our own life, including our own health, including our own youth. And many people become very bitter from having it all and then having it all taken away. And those people will suffer enormously. But there's a way to turn all of this so that it begins to feed our spirit, what we're dependent upon decreases, so that there's less resistance to losing, because we're not fighting the inevitable any longer. And then in that relaxed response, the rift between ourselves and life heals. And there will be no more grief, because we will then abide within the life rather than outside. The reason we grieve is because we try to sustain the unsustainable. And so let every loss be a reflection just on the dynamics of what life is. At the moment of loss, there's an opportunity to move with life in a way that it's disorienting. When we have everything we want, it's all lined up, we feel very safe within all of that. And the safety, we can relax, it becomes very habitual. It's like our cat. The cat, if I change one thing in the morning, it gets very upset with me. You know, if I don't brush it on time, if I don't put it out on time, if I don't feed it on time. And I sometimes do it deliberately, and it gets... it just isn't, it isn't into the spirit of learning like that. So it's just, okay, so I feed it on time if I can. But when we count on something and then something is taken away, there's a moment in which there's a hole, there's a opening in life, in which what has been counted on is not there. And that is extraordinarily upsetting to the mind, but it's where the heart abides. It's where the heart can be most alive. Just a story. I was with a woman who was dying in a inpatient unit with her children and family around, and she was talking us through her death. And she was telling us, this is very rare, it's the only time it ever happened in all the years I was in hospice, but she was saying, I can no longer feel my body anymore. I can no longer see. I can no longer hear. And then she said, oh my God, I'm no longer in my body. And then she tried to say something and she died. So just to make a long story short, all of us were standing around the bed listening to her talk us through her death in amazement and wonder. And then she died. And we were all left in this moment of pure amazement, of pure the sacred was in the room. And we were all there in the sacred. And we were all there together, and we were there for several minutes by the bedside, just being absolutely still. Then one of the children, who was 13, started weeping because her mother had died. And then we all went into action. All the hospice people went through their roles and their comfort and all of that. And then the sacred left. Which is fair enough. But the point was that there was a moment there when the loss took us to something that was sacred. The having and the not having. You see that? What is that? What is that edge What is that moment with that crest of wonder when you're had it and then you don't have it and you have nowhere to go in terms of blame? And that's the, we love to blame the doctor who didn't see the lump, the, you know, all that. Because then we can, instead of being vulnerable on the crest, we can then be angry and get ourselves embodied in the anger. Because you can't get embodied in the vulnerability of the loss. You can only be exposed to the vulnerability of the loss, you see? So then when we miss that, which most of us do after loss, then we have to deal with the grief, the residue of the not having and the wanting life to be sustainable when it's not. And so, and that's okay. But the way we deal with that is that we have to be very human about it. Let it tender us. Don't let it become a sour note on your life or that. But let it just tender you towards the loss of all things, towards the ephemeral quality of all things, so that when you're looking at the leaves fall from a tree or the changing patterns of weather or whatever you might be looking at and focusing and notice the sense of inevitability of loss, the inevitability of change. You see, so you stay tender on that, and you stay open, you stay alive to that. So the grief can take us to that, as well as being alive to the sense of grief, being gentle with our sense of grief, being allowing it to be paying attention to it and being dignified within it. And by that I don't mean proper, I just mean not to drive us into some kind of antic or anything, but just, whoa, this is, notice how it's difficult. And you feel it, and you feel, and it takes you just, it opens life. It just shows you life. It just shows you the raw quality of life, if you look at it, you see. And you have to stay tender in that, and you have to not distract yourself from that necessarily, as long as you can feel it and just honor it, not trying to shake yourself from it, or because everybody who will be around you who feels that in you, not everybody, but many people will be very, it's hard for other people, and they'll want you to get over your grief so they don't have to be with you in your grief. And so they'll say, would you like to go to a movie or something like that, rather than tell me the story of your friends and your relationship. So you have to be aware that most people aren't going to accompany you in grief. And you just walk it. And, you know, it feels like sometimes, depending upon how important that relationship was, it feels like your heart's going to die. It feels like it's going to it'll never bounce back. And that's it right there, you see. And you don't move from that either. And it does bounce back. And life knows how to rebuild upon itself if we don't distract ourselves from the feeling. If you distract yourself from the feeling, then all sorts of crippling emotional responses occur that are side results of not having felt the grief. So just honoring that love, because the grief is the sustainability of the love, that you loved him. You really cared about this man or this person. And then from time to time, just ask yourself, which is another very deep and profound thing to ask yourself, is the love still there? And it is. It doesn't rely on the form, the person in form, to be there in order for love to manifest. And the love was what was important in the relationship to begin with. And it's endured the loss of the form. And so the essence of the relationship is maintained. And even though this person, it sounds like they lived in a different part of the country.
Yeah, back where I grew up.
Back where you grew up. And so you didn't see him very much.
Once a year.
And so you're not seeing him very much now. Mm-hmm. But everything seems to be different. And yet nothing is really different. Yeah, so this is when it's really coming up for you, because it's at that time of year. But even if we're in very close relationship with somebody, if you look at the amount of time that you aren't really relating to the person, it's the vast majority of the day. And yet when the person goes, you're still not relating to the person the vast majority of the day, but something just seems like, you see? It's just so interesting when you really... Yes. Right, it's very different. Very different, because the difference is the mental... It's not the love. The love is still there. It's the counting on the form to be consistent. Yeah. No, right. You just thought he was always going to be there. Which many of us do in an important relationship. Right. So the other thing is to do some ritual. Put his picture out there, light some incense, some flowers. You can chant or do whatever you feel is appropriate. Do some readings, you know. Talk to the picture and tell him what he meant to you. Good. Good. Good wake is always... Okay. Okay, good luck to you and you bet. Other questions or yes. The question is about worry and concern, and whether there's anything worth worrying about. We certainly do enough of it, don't we? We do an awful lot of it, and it's part of the way I feel that in isolation we feel that we can maintain emotional residue with something is through worry. You know, whether it's our daughter who's at college, whether it's, you know, our son who's hiking in the mountains, or whether it's our spouse who's driving home in a rainstorm. What does worry give us? You see, that's the question I always ask. What does it give us? Why is it maintained? Because we maintain it. Why is it maintained? What is it doing? And I don't think it's too different than the dialogue we just had about grief, and the sense that of my dependence on the world to sustain itself. And when there is a risk of that not happening, then how I meet that risk is through worry. It's the way we think we maintain our caring about something. Somebody's in the hospital or being ill somewhere or something. Unless I'm worrying about them, in our mind, we question whether we really care about the person. Well, that we're not dwelling on them all the time, thinking about them all the time. We think, well, maybe I don't care about them to the extent that we should, whatever that means. And that then worry becomes the way we... prove our affection for somebody. Now, if that isn't the most insane thing, we really, you see, you laugh because you know it's insane. But does that stop you from worrying? You have to use your insanity, the knowledge of insanity, to take you to sanity. You have to say, wait a second here, look at this now. Do I care about this person? And that's a genuine question to ask. Is the affection genuine, or has it been, is it inauthentic, or is it authentic? That's where you start. You don't have to care about everybody. You're not going to possibly care about everybody. But is there any sense of your needing to care? And when the caring isn't there, I mean, just for a minute to think here. Let's look. What about this worry here? What is it doing for me? Is it healthy? Is it wise? Is it genuine? You ask yourself those questions, and let us say that there is a genuine affection for somebody. say your spouse, your daughter, or something. Does the worry prove anything? Does it do anything? Does it extend? It's an attempt to extend our control, isn't it? It's an attempt to extend our control into areas in which we have no power whatsoever. And because we have no power whatsoever, the only power we do have is mentally trying to concern ourselves with events in which we don't have power. And we do that through worry. I think that's interesting to me. Why not just say, I don't know if you're coming back. I hope you come back, but I don't know if you're coming back. And then that's that. And then they come back. Oh, great to see you. Or they hike Mount Hood. Or Mount Hood, right. And then they don't come back. And then you deal with that. But I don't see a lot of sane usage for worry. I just don't. I think it's an overextension of our sense of power. It's plain God. And it may be inauthentic. Let's look at the relationship and see if there's genuine caring there. I mean, if you ever really think, I mean, those people, those hikers on Mount Hood, for instance, if you just hold their situation, you start caring about them. If you just read it very cursory, if you just read the news like the poem says, as some distant person that doesn't mean anything, then you don't care. But if you hold the news as two people, you see their picture perhaps, you start caring about these two people who are up on the hill. You empathize with what they must be going through. You empathize with their pain. But you don't have to worry. It's not a worry. You wish them well. You want them to be safe. But that's not worry. Worry is not, metta isn't worry. Love or affection isn't worry. See, that's an extension. That's going too far. That's carrying the affection too far. It's moving into the manipulative. And so then you say, no, not that, I'm not, that mind doesn't do that. I'm not going to do that. It doesn't stop you from caring. It just stops you from worrying, really. So on a, that's the only, that's all I can say. Yes. He's right.
And I was shocked because it's not the first time this happened. Only he used a couple of stories that were, I think, meant to be persuasive.
Yeah, but you...
I just want to know the right action here. I don't want to break my separation, my connection with him. And so, I'm not worried.
The question is, she has a brother who's sent her a highly charged email regarding her opportunity to take God now and be saved. See, when my brother, who is also a fundamental Christian, sends me something like that, which from time to time he does, you know, the part of me says, well, he's coming off on me again. But that doesn't last long. And I think, let's see, he's trying to get me into the sacred. Okay, was I in the sacred? Quite likely I wasn't. I was thinking about something. So let me come in and say, he's right. This moment is the most precious moment. And if there's going to be any salvation for the rest of my life, it's better begin now. I just reread it. I just put it into terms, right? And he's absolutely correct. Right? Absolutely correct. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Why make a big thing out of it?
Well, I don't want to. That's why.
Then don't. Don't make a thing out of it. Don't. You don't have to. You don't have to do that. You just put it in, reinterpret it. You reinterpret it. And when he comes, when you get together, you don't have to make, I don't. You don't have to make a big issue out of it. You know, and so then, he sent me an email. He says, you know, the reason we don't get together much anymore, and I'm very happy for him to come. He lives in Baltimore, so it's not like we're around the corner from each other, but he says it's because you my God's bigger than your God. That's okay. That doesn't bring anything out of me. It doesn't bring a defense out of me. He's needing whatever he needs from those kind of statements allows him his own security, which I would never try to take from him. He needs what he has, or he wouldn't have what he has. He needs it exactly at that. And he's trying to do battle with an infidel. Me. Which is okay if he wants to, it doesn't, none of that, unless I swallow it, which I never do, bothers me in the least. I don't want to make an enemy of him, for him, with him at all. And so, if I respond, I try to respond in accordance with his language. As much as I can do without making my, being inauthentic with what I know to be true. And through our dialogues, which have happened every once in a while, he'll say something to me. I say, well, here's another way of looking at that. You know, sometimes it gets into him. And he says, well, you know, he pauses. So I just, when someone becomes conscious, those that haven't become conscious are held by those who have. It's important for every person who has become more conscious to hold people who haven't become that conscious. Not to make a problem out of their lack of attention to mindfulness. Because everybody has there's a perfect timing in this thing. And one of the phases of that timing is fundamentalism, I'm afraid. Or it seems to be. And that's an evolutionary point of reference where the only way they have to have a very personal relationship and a very autocratic relationship with their God in order for that God to be able to get in and for anything holy to be seen. Okay, so that's a very infantile approach to the sacred. But I also say, you know, there are somebody who's 3 years old, you don't start teaching them calculus. You know, you're one and one. And that's not, I'm not being, it's not a pejorative. I'm not trying to put the person down or it's not being, not, it's not, it's like, okay, you know, this is just the evolution. You see it too. Someone, when you're conscious, you see people who are unconscious and most of their actions are attempts to make them secure and feel safe. So they have a God outside of them. And that's necessary for that evolution to move forth. So if you, like a 3-year-old, you don't demand to be a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old. You take them at 3 and you just patiently, they grow from 3 to 4 to 5 to 6. I really look at life like that. You see, when you do, then there really isn't a lot of judgment in having a 3-year-old for a brother who's actually older than you. I mean, you judge 3-year-olds? I don't judge 3-year-olds. That's just what they're 3 years old. It's not a judgment. And so, you never have to make a problem out of anyone like that or like anything. And it makes it an awful lot easier. There's a Taoist saying that says, you know, if you're in a boat and another boat hits your boat, but there's no one in that boat to yell at, you don't yell. Right? So you empty your boat. And you just, whatever he, however he attacks, that it doesn't cause for any retaliation in attack. It doesn't upset me. It doesn't do anything. I'm there, you know, if he wants to. So if his God wants, if he wants his God to be bigger, fine, he's bigger. Now, how's that? Yeah, it just doesn't, okay. Yes. Yes. Practice and addiction. Any particular type of addiction?
Well, I'll just pose a hypothetical. Let's say I'm addicted to eating chocolate.
He's been following me around. Okay. So, let's see. Okay, so... well, I mean... you know, there are levels of addiction. That one I don't really consider to be an addiction. I'm not an alcoholic. See, So just addiction. Okay. It's interesting, you know, having grown up in a family that had an alcoholic in my family, I saw very early in my teens that I could easily go that way. And there were a number of occasions in which I did. And then, I don't know, there's just some sense of sanity. That's the only word that comes to mind that said, no, this isn't going to be a life that leads anywhere. So I stepped out of it very early, even before I was out of high school, into that kind of thing. But I felt the compelling, resonance of that. I still do. You know, you have a drink of anything, and I can see that you could drink a lot. I can see that. I can feel it in myself. And you see the power of something over you. Now, I can't divorce the practice from this because, when I have that kind of relationship to something, I'm interested in it, actually. I say, what is this? What is this compelling need here? And I want to feel emotionally what's trying to be satisfied in that. And what, you know, is it, what is it, you see? Is it emotional safety? Is it stepping out of a kind of introverted way? Or is it just being more careless or less structured? I don't know. But you look at all that stuff and you go, whoa, this is interesting. So what's keeping me from that level of ease, which is really what all that represents? What's keeping me from this level of ease now? Why do I have to take something in order to be at that state of unclarity in order to be at ease? You see, what is it that's keeping me? So that's the way my mind goes. That's the way my practice works. But I do think there's physical, chemical, urges in one that become so compelling. I mean, I don't want to ridicule or put these down at all. They are really compelling, compelling physical needs that people have for certain addictive qualities, substances, in which for the anyone that's not almost a master in the practice, hands off. You know, just don't play with temperance. Don't play with moderation. Don't do it. It's playing with fire. Um, And just carry a quality of mindfulness, of awareness, whenever you're approaching around other people who are doing that same thing, drinking, let's say. And just a level of self-observation. Be very careful when there's emotional neediness, like despondency or despair or depression, in which you're kind of giving up on the world and moving directly, almost chemically, towards something that will allow you to forget temporarily. That's when it's really the mindfulness needs to be just crisp. And so the emotional neediness or just any waning energetically of your sanity. All of those can be extraordinarily helpful. And if you find yourself like eating chocolate is something that, you know, it's hard to put that in the same line as an alcoholic or something, but you know, if you got to be like cigarette smoking, for instance, which is extraordinarily addicting, one of the things to do is to actually smoke the cigarette consciously. So you might, every time you smoke, you sit in the same place, if you can, at your home. And you take every bit of you puff it, you feel the smoke going into your lungs, what that feels like to the body. You blow it out, you see what effect it has on other people and on yourself as you blow it out. You just feel the whole quality of the cigarette, the taste of it, everything. So you really get a complete overview of the impact of the cigarette on your physical body, the sense of wanting, the neediness of it, and how I'm not able to hold that with any sort of attention without acting on it. Making it as conscious as you possibly can, smoking that cigarette from the first light up to the last puff, totally conscious, total awareness. I think if people did that for one or two or a few cigarettes, they would have a radically different shift in their intentionality to quit smoking. But they don't. They get caught in the conversation of it and the social and all of that. It used to be so acceptable that it was just part of the whole milieu of interacting. It's not like that anymore, thank goodness. But the really seeing what this substance that I'm playing with, be it chocolate or crack, what it's doing to me, what it's doing to my relationship, what's doing to my life, what's doing to my clarity, what's it doing to what I hold most sacred in life, besides just the level of enjoyment, comfort, ease, or whatever it's doing to the mind in that moment, which is just a mind state. I also had a friend who said, I can't say this because I haven't done the number of drugs that he did, but he tried all the different drugs back in the 60s, and he said he never did anything, and he did them all. He said that he, with any experiences that he had in all these drugs, he had the same experiences in meditation without the drugs. So the reason he gave up all those drugs was that he found the resource, the authentic resource in his meditation. So anyone else? We have time for maybe one or two more. Yes.
I tend to be really judgmental, and I note my judgmentalness, and I also note that the amount of judgmentalness that I hold, and so I turn my judgmentalness on me.
Yeah.
And et cetera.
Yes, yes, I've got it.
So,
it's a very common theme. It's talking about judgment and then judging the person who's judging, and on it goes. It's not so helpful just to be mindful of judging. That's a start, but it's not very, it's not really where the disease lies. The disease lies in the pain within us that causes the judgment at all. We judge because we are feeling diminished in ourselves in that moment of judgment. And what we're trying to do is to buoy ourselves up a little bit in relationship to the person we are judging by putting the other person down. And so if you go to the pain of how you feel about yourself in that moment, rather than into who you're judging and why, or just the act of judging, because that's a symptom. You really get a sense of how much this sense of unworthiness or inadequacy drives so much of our life in body, speech, and mind. And when you get interested in how much it drives your life, because it becomes so overwhelmingly obvious as you start you go from the trunk of the tree down to the root system, and the root system's all into the tentacles of the roots, you begin to see how really pervasive this particular activity is. And if you start following it back down, you begin to see how much of our life is a cast from a self-disadvantage in terms of shame, guilt, judgment, or just self-doubt that plagues us all. And it's throughout your spiritual life and physical life, it could be the theme of choice to really start looking and investigating. Because it will stop you dead in your tracks spiritually. It'll stop everything. But at some point, spirituality requires the end of self-doubt to move on. Because self-doubt is the very primal state of being that many of us have, sort of the root cause of our personality, of our character, the root issue of our personality, and all of its disguises and permutations of inadequacy and unworthiness and all that. And at some point, when you start questioning the sense of self itself, that will arise. And it will arise as a monarch. And unless we have dealt with it sufficiently to know its power, to know, because it will undermine our intentionality. I was dialoguing with somebody in Vancouver, this is a couple of weeks ago, and we were going very deeply together, and then he said, I can't do this. I'm not able to do this. I don't believe I can do this. I said, you don't believe you can do this. Is the only thing in this moment that's stopping you from doing it. The assumption that you cannot do this. He said, I can't help it. I can't do it. And I said, then what you need to do is to put your full attention in questioning that self-doubt. Because if you leave it alone, it feels like you can do a lot in your spiritual work and not ever have to deal with your mental neurosis. But inevitably, the mental neurosis is what ties you together as a person. It's what forms you as a person. It's where your belief and assumptions are most emphatically held. And you have to test those. You have to question those. You have to investigate those. You have to prove those to be not true. I cannot do this. You can hear it, can't you? That's just like, that's it. That's it. That's it. It's not that I don't want to do that, and I was looking to see if the I can't was really I don't want to, which would have been fine with me. He's just not ready. But he believed that he wasn't able to do it. Now, I don't believe that about anyone, ever, whoever. It doesn't matter who they are. I don't believe that. I believe that they're not ready, but I do not believe that they can't. And if we can dialogue sufficiently together so that I can show you that as an assumption held in emptiness, then that cannot form to prevent the understanding of the sacred. But that's where it has to go. So judgment is an indication that most of us have of the power of the monarch. And this is just his This is just his gesture. This is his the symptom, the very minimal symptomology of his power. But boy, when you start getting close to him, he raises up, or she, in all their majesty. I cannot do this. You see what you need here. It's not true, period. It's not true. Why isn't it true? Because when you look at the I on which that assumption is based not being true, then all the assumptions on which it is based have to be false. And that can be seen very quickly, really. That can be seen very quickly. But if you hold the assumption true, then you have to hold the I to be true. You can't do it that. You can't bypass the assumption and release the I, because the assumption holds the I. But if you look at the I, then the assumption cannot maintain. It's like Teflon. Can't stick. Although it keeps trying to, but it can't stick. Yes.
It kind of goes along with the questions about worry, judgment, self-doubt. This one's got the face of fear. And the question's really more about the process of dealing with this, because we've talked about investigation and asking if it's true and you know, really being with it, what good am I getting out of it? There's the mental awareness of this is not very useful.
Right.
Me trying to control things. Or
right.
Where I'm at right now in my process around it is saying, okay, fear, you can sit right here.
Good.
But you're not making decisions.
Good. Good. That's good, Suze. The question is about fear and the controlling aspect of fear. That's beautiful. And ask yourself, when it arises, what would I do now if I weren't afraid? You see, give yourself another alternative. Give yourself another alternative. So that the only living reality isn't the one the fear is speaking. Which often is so consuming that you feel like you have there's no other opportunity except to reverse your course. What would I do now if I weren't afraid? What would you do now if you weren't afraid in your life? Then, and this will always be, you won't always be able on some of the more dramatic qualities of fear, you won't be able to do it, but on some of them it becomes obvious, and there won't be sufficient fear to hold you in place. And then the action from the resolution of moving despite fear, not in reaction to fear, but despite it being there, will strengthen that the conviction that fear doesn't hold the truth. Because you'll see, you can do it. You can do, okay, I'm afraid of speaking in public. You get up. And you still are afraid of speaking in public, and you speak in public. And the next time you do it, and the next time, you have a lot of fear. And then at one point, you get up, and there may be a slight anxiety, but that's okay. Despite that, you go ahead. Because each time, you're weighing in on the sanity and the perceived reality of what fear is telling you, that everybody will laugh at you or whatever it is that we fear will happen when we speak in public, doesn't occur. And you say, well, then you stop believing in that mental fabricated lie, which fear is, because fear doesn't know what's going to happen. It just says it does. It says, I know what's going to happen. You get up, everybody's going to laugh at you. Well, I'm not going to get up if everybody's going to laugh at me. Therefore, I'll stay seated. You get up, nobody laughs at you. Maybe it doesn't know the whole story here. And so even though it feels very, you know, compelling when you have fear and anxiety and some of the more dramatic things. And sometimes you just need to be patient with it. Just be patient here. Let it have its day. If I've told you the story, some of you have heard my story. So I'm only one person with only so many stories. So I had a nightmare. And I would go into one of these like psycho houses, you know, up in the third story. And I this incredible cold, chill terror would enter me. And I'd run out of the house and I'd wake up, you know, like profusely sweating. And it was a reoccurring nightmare. So I got into meditation and I was meditating for a while. I had that reoccurring nightmare. It happened. Went up into that. I can feel it as I was, went up into that room, felt the chair, the chill, started to lunge for the steps. And I said, I'm not leaving. I popped down on the floor in the dream. I said, bring it on. And it disappeared. It just, that's it. And it never occurred again. I have that from time to time. Elle and I were watching some movie or something, I can't remember what it was, but where people were running from something like, you know, like a mummy or something, you know, one of those. That walks so damn slow anyway, you could be. I don't understand. But anyway, like Godzilla or something, right? And everybody's going, ah, like that. I just wouldn't do it. I just wouldn't run. I'm not going to live like this. Step on me. If you're willing to die, and I mean it, if you're willing to die, then that doesn't have any, what does it have over you? I would rather die than live like that. I would rather die than live, you won't live like that. They try to get us to live like that with these red alerts and all that. Okay, so you're, you know, you. I'm not going to. That's it. So you see, at some point, there's a certain way that I'm not willing to live. And I'm not willing to live at the expense of my sanity and or my integrity, what I know to be true. So that's it. You're going to go to Iraq and fight. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. Or I'll put you in jail. Put me in jail. If you're willing to do whatever it is that they are going to tell you you have to do, if you don't do whatever it is they want you to do, then there's nothing they can do. And fear has that. That's it. So your integrity becomes the most important quality in your heart. The most important quality, most important thing in your whole life, more important than anything, is your integrity. I'm not going to live like that. No. Put a gun to my head. You say it's easy for him to say. I'm telling you, I would not run. I know that. And I would not fight in Iraq. I know that. It's not just words. You feel it in your body. You feel it in your cells. That's the level of conviction. I want to thank everybody tonight.